They called it safety. They called it access. They said this was how regular people finally got in early. By the time the filings landed, the money was already gone. In court records, investigators described a crypto investment program that spread quietly through Latino neighborhoods, church circles, family chats, and community events. Promises were simple. Steady returns, low risk, a chance to build something together. Spanish language presentations carried confidence. Familiar faces carried trust. According to regulators, the returns did not come from trading or growth. They came from new money. When fresh deposits slowed, excuses followed. Delays, technical issues, market conditions. Behind the scenes, the math tightened. What was proven at filing was the scale. Hundreds of millions raised, thousands of investors touched. What remained alleged was intent. Whether this began as fraud or became one under pressure was left for the courts. What no document disputed was the damage. When the flow stopped, silence replaced reassurance, and an entire community was left staring at the same question. How did something sold as protection turn into collapse? Chapter 1. The promise that looked safe. The first warning did not come from a raid or a whistleblower. It came from math. According to civil filings, the investment program showed signs that did not align with normal crypto operations. Returns appeared smooth, too smooth. They did not spike or dip with market volatility. They moved on schedule like payroll. For regulators, that pattern mattered. Markets breathe. Ponzi structures pretend they do not. At the surface, the program looked careful, even conservative. Investors were told their money was placed into crypto assets designed to weather swings. Risk was framed as managed, controlled, professional. The pitch avoided hype language, no talk of moonshots, no promises of overnight wealth, just steady growth, just patience. That tone was deliberate. Presentations were often delivered in Spanish, not translated later, but built that way from the start. The language was warm, familiar, and reassuring. Speakers referenced shared struggles, immigration, long work hours, exclusion from traditional finance. The message was not about beating the system. It was about finally being included in it. According to filings, trust did not come from glossy marketing. It came from proximity. Friends brought friends. Family members vouched for organizers. Community figures spoke on their behalf. The program moved through WhatsApp groups, small meetings, and private introductions. It did not feel like a pitch. It felt like an opportunity being passed along quietly. The structure, as described by regulators, was simple on purpose. Money went in, returns came out on a schedule, participants were encouraged to reinvest rather than withdraw. Those who referred others received bonuses. Nothing was presented as mandatory. Everything was framed as optional, flexible, and respectful. Early participants were paid. That fact mattered more than any promise. Checks cleared, transfers landed, screenshots circulated. Proof of payment became the strongest marketing tool. According to the filings, those early payouts were real. They built momentum, they silenced doubt, they turned caution into confidence. The program scaled quickly. What began as small investments grew into larger commitments. Some participants rolled over savings, others borrowed. A few liquidated retirement accounts. The pitch remained the same. Safe, community-backed, carefully managed. If anyone asked how returns were generated, the answer stayed vague but calm. Trading strategies, arbitrage, professional teams overseas, nothing specific enough to verify, nothing alarming enough to reject. Regulators later alleged that this vagueness was not accidental. As described in the complaint, the program pooled funds rather than tracking individual accounts. Investor dashboards showed balances and gains, but those numbers were not tied to identifiable blockchain activity. There was no transparent ledger, no independent audit. Participants relied on internal statements and the continued arrival of payments. The absence of visible losses was read as proof of competence. Inside the community, skepticism carried social cost. Questioning the program meant questioning people you trusted, relatives, friends, church members. According to investigators, this dynamic slowed early resistance. Doubt did not spread easily when everyone believed they were protecting one another. The filings described how organizers leaned into that dynamic. They emphasized unity, loyalty, shared benefit. Investors were told that withdrawals hurt the group. Reinvestment was framed as commitment. Patience was framed as maturity. At this stage, no regulator had intervened. No formal warning had been issued. The program existed in a gray space between private investment and public solicitation. That space allowed it to grow without immediate oversight. According to enforcement documents, that growth was rapid. Money flowed in from multiple states. The total climbed steadily. Tens of millions became hundreds of millions. The exact figure would later be disputed, but filings referenced a sum approaching $300 million. The scale alone shifted the risk profile. What once looked like a small, community-based investment now carried systemic consequences. Still outwardly, nothing appeared broken. Payments continued, organizers remained visible, communications stayed frequent. When crypto markets dipped, the program did not. That stability was used as evidence of insulation. According to regulators, it was also evidence of artificial control. Behind the scenes, investigators alleged the program relied on constant inflows. New money funded old promises. Referral incentives accelerated recruitment. The structure required growth not for expansion, but for survival. At this stage, intent remained unproven. The filings were careful on that point. They described behavior, not motives. They outlined mechanisms without declaring when or if fraud began. That distinction mattered legally. It also mattered to victims. Some participants believed the organizers lost control. Others believed it was deception from day one. Chapter 1 does not resolve that question. It establishes the environment in which the program thrived. Trust came first. Money followed. The first cracks appeared quietly. According to filings, withdrawals began to take longer. Customer service responses slowed. Explanations surfaced. Network congestion, compliance reviews, temporary holds. None of these excuses triggered panic on their own. Individually, they sounded reasonable. Collectively, they formed a pattern. By the time outside attention sharpened, the program was deeply embedded in the community it targeted. The damage potential extended beyond finances. It touched relationships, reputations, and cultural trust. That was the real risk regulators would later describe. Not just the money raised, but the way it was raised. The promise of safety wrapped in familiarity. Opportunity sold as protection. At the end of this phase, no doors had been kicked in. No assets frozen, no charges announced. On paper, the program still existed. In reality, the pressure was building. The math was tightening, the inflows needed to stay high, the silence between payments was growing. And somewhere outside the community, eyes were now watching. The question was no longer whether the returns were real. It was how long the illusion could hold before the system collapsed under its own weight. Chapter 2, Money in Silence Out. The system did not fail all at once, it slowed. According to civil filings, the first visible strain appeared when withdrawals no longer matched expectations. Payments still arrived, but not on schedule. What had once taken days now took weeks. Investors were told to wait. The explanations sounded technical, not alarming. Network congestion, internal reviews, temporary delays tied to compliance. Individually, each excuse seemed plausible. Together, they formed a new reality. Participants who raised concerns were reassured privately. According to investigators, organizers avoided public acknowledgments of trouble. Group chats stayed positive. Official updates focused on patience and trust. Anyone pressing too hard was told they were misunderstanding the process. Recruitment did not slow, it accelerated. As returns tightened, referral incentives were emphasized. New investors were framed as strengthening the system. Bringing in friends and relatives was described as helping everyone. According to filings, this period marked a shift. The program leaned more heavily on inflows to meet existing obligations. This was the point regulators later described as structural dependence. Money entered the system in large waves. According to enforcement documents, there was no corresponding evidence of market activity capable of producing the promised yields. Instead, funds were allegedly routed internally to meet payout expectations. Earlier participants were paid using later deposits. That mechanism was alleged not proven at the time. What was proven was the absence of transparency. Investors could not independently verify how funds were being used. Account dashboards showed growth, but those figures were internal representations. They were not tied to identifiable transactions on public blockchains. When participants asked for clarity, answers remained general. The cultural dynamics deepened the silence. In many cases, according to filings, investors hesitated to speak publicly. Admitting doubt meant admitting error. It meant acknowledging that a trusted friend or family member might have led them into harm. That pressure mattered. Some participants withdrew quietly. Others doubled down. They reinvested returns that existed only on paper. The program encouraged this behavior. Reinvestment was framed as discipline. Withdrawals were framed as short-term thinking. Behind the scenes, the math grew harsher. According to regulators, the inflow required to sustain payouts increased dramatically. The pool expanded, but the liabilities expanded faster. Each promised return created future obligation. Without genuine profit generation, the system relied on constant expansion. That expansion began to draw attention. Complaints reached state regulators. Questions surfaced inside financial oversight offices. According to filings, patterns emerged that aligned with known Ponzi indicators. Predictable returns, heavy reliance on recruitment, limited transparency, delayed withdrawals. At this stage, there was still no public enforcement action. Investigators gathered information quietly. Subpoenas were prepared. Financial records were reviewed. Inside the program, stress became visible. Organizers became harder to reach. Scheduled calls were postponed. Meetings shifted from public spaces to private ones. According to accounts summarized in filings, communication became defensive. Tone changed. Reassurance turned into urgency. Participants were urged not to panic. Panic, they were told, would hurt everyone. This language mattered. It framed skepticism as harm. It discouraged collective scrutiny. It kept the system functioning longer than it otherwise might have. Losses mounted quietly. Some investors received partial payments. Others received none. According to regulators, funds were not evenly distributed. Payouts appeared selective. Those with visibility or influence were prioritized. This allegation would later carry weight in court filings. What could be proven at this stage was scale. The total funds raised, as described by enforcement authorities, approached $300 million. Thousands of individuals were affected. The geographic reach extended far beyond the original community hubs. The silence grew heavier. WhatsApp messages went unanswered. Emails bounced. Promised updates did not arrive. When explanations came, they contradicted earlier statements. Technical issues were replaced by regulatory delays. Delays were replaced by silence. Trust began to fracture. Some participants compared notes privately. Screenshots circulated showing unpaid balances. The narrative of safety began to crack. According to filings, this internal sharing accelerated concern more than any external warning. By the time regulators moved toward action, the system was already unraveling. The inflows slowed, recruitment stalled. The structure dependent on constant growth began to collapse inward. Obligations exceeded available funds. The illusion of stability could no longer be maintained. Intent remained a legal question. Regulators did not claim to know when deception began. They documented what happened. They documented how money moved. They documented what investors were told and when. What could not be disputed was outcome. By the end of this phase, many participants had lost access to their funds. Savings were trapped. Retirement accounts were drained. Family relationships were strained. The damage extended beyond balance sheets. The program that had promised protection now offered only uncertainty. Outside pressure intensified. Investigators finalized filings. Enforcement decisions moved forward. The quiet phase was ending. The question was no longer whether the system was failing. It was what would happen when failure became official. Chapter 3. When the clock ran out, the end did not arrive with sirens. It arrived with paperwork. According to court records, the civil enforcement action began quietly. Filings were prepared. Financial records were assembled. Allegations were framed carefully, separating what could be proven from what was still under investigation. When the action became public, many participants learned about it the same way they learned their payments had stopped. Through silence breaking into shock, the filings alleged that the investment program had operated as a Ponzi structure. New investor funds were used to pay earlier participants. Promised returns were not generated through legitimate crypto trading or asset growth. Instead, the system relied on continuous inflows to survive. Those allegations carried weight, but they were still allegations. What was proven at the time of filing was narrower and more concrete. Hundreds of millions of dollars had been raised. Thousands of investors had been affected. Funds were commingled. Transparency was absent. Withdrawals had been delayed or denied. Operations had effectively halted. The court moved quickly. Emergency motions sought to freeze assets. The goal was not punishment. It was preservation. Regulators argued that remaining funds needed to be secured before they disappeared. the court agreed. Accounts were frozen. Transfers were blocked. The program, which had depended on movement, was suddenly locked in place. For participants, this was the moment hope collapsed. Some still believed the organizers would fix it, that the intervention was temporary, that trading would resume, that funds would be released. Others understood immediately. The system was done. Whatever money remained would now be divided by courts, not promises. The filings described what investigators found when they traced the money. Funds moved between accounts with no clear investment purpose. Payments aligned with recruitment cycles rather than market activity. When inflows slowed, payouts slowed. When inflows stopped, payouts stopped entirely. These patterns were not disputed. What remained contested was intent. Defense filings argued mismanagement rather than fraud. They suggested the program began as a legitimate investment effort that collapsed under pressure. Regulators rejected that framing. They pointed to the structure itself. A structure that required constant recruitment to function was not accidental, they argued. It was inherent. The court did not rule on intent immediately. Civil actions move deliberately. Evidence is weighed. Arguments are tested. At this stage, the priority was control. Receivers were appointed to oversee remaining assets. Their task was grim. Identify what was left, determine where it had gone, calculate losses, communicate with victims. None of this brought relief. It brought accounting. Victims were asked to submit claims. For many, that process was humiliating. It required admitting loss. It required documentation. It required patience. According to filings, some participants struggled to provide records. Investments had been made informally, through cash transfers, through peer introductions. Trust had replaced paperwork. That absence now worked against them. The community impact became visible. Families argued. Friendships ended. Church groups fractured. The same trust that had accelerated growth now amplified blame. Some participants accused those who referred them. Others defended organizers, insisting the system had been sabotaged. Regulators did not engage in those debates. Their filings stayed clinical. Dates, amounts, accounts, statements. They described what happened without language of betrayal or shame. The human cost did not fit neatly into exhibits. Recovery prospects were limited. In Ponzi cases, early payouts reduce later recovery. Money that has already been spent cannot be reclaimed easily. According to court disclosures, total losses would far exceed recoverable assets. Many investors would receive only fractions of what they put in. Some would receive nothing. That reality settled slowly. As weeks passed, the urgency faded into resignation. Updates from the receiver arrived periodically. Each one confirmed what participants already felt. The hole was too deep. The money was gone. The legal process continued. Motions, responses, hearings, none of it restored trust. For regulators, the case became another data point. A familiar pattern wearing new clothes. Crypto language layered over old mechanics, community targeting replacing cold calls, familiarity replacing formal advertising. The filings emphasized this shift. Fraud did not always arrive from strangers anymore. Sometimes it arrived through people you knew, people who believed what they were selling, people who trusted the system until it broke. The question of accountability remained open. Civil cases focus on recovery and injunctions. Criminal cases require higher burdens. At the time of filing, no criminal convictions had been announced. Investigations can take years. Evidence must meet standards beyond suspicion. What the community wanted was simpler answers, apologies, responsibility. Those did not arrive with the filings. The final damage extended beyond money. Participants described losing faith in investment opportunities entirely. Some withdrew from community groups. Others avoided conversations about finance altogether. The language of opportunity became toxic. Regulators acknowledged this harm indirectly. In public statements, they warned about affinity fraud, schemes that exploit shared identity, shared language, shared trust. The filings did not name culture as the problem. They named its exploitation. In the end, the case resolved into records and rulings, but its impact lingered. The program had promised safety. It had promised inclusion. It had promised a way forward. Instead, it left a community navigating loss together and alone. The final filings did not end with moral judgment. They ended with accounting, balances, percentages, timelines. Justice in this context was incomplete by design. Money could be recovered partially. Trust could not. The last question was not whether the system had failed. That was already clear. The question was what lessons would survive longer than the damage. For those who lived through it, the answer was immediate. Safety is not a promise. It is something that must be proven every step of the way.